Welcome back. Reminder to the attorneys that the time clock should be visible if you use the gallery view or select the gallery view in Zoom. And we would remind you to please mute your microphones when you are not speaking. With that, I'll call our third case on the calendar today. That's A21-1735, Engstrom v. White Birch, Inc. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
You will each be given 15 minutes for argument this morning, and appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's going to be an audio recording of this, so please, when beginning your argument, identify yourself and your client for the audio record. With that, Mr. Christensen, are you prepared to begin?
I'm ready, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Carl Christensen. I represent Dan Engstrom, the plaintiff in this matter. We're here today to ask the court to allow my client to have this case heard on the merits. A brief recitation of the facts, this court's actually seen this case before, but I'll go through that quickly. Mr. Engstrom's mother owned a timeshare interest in Breezy Point, Minnesota. She died in 2015, and about a year later, Mr. Engstrom received correspondence from the respondents saying that he also had an interest in this timeshare. He was surprised by that, and along with the communication he received saying he had an interest was an unrecorded deed and other internal communications, including a joint ownership authorization that indicate that was the basis for the respondent to indicate that indeed he was an owner of this timeshare. He responded that he never owned this timeshare, never received any communications that would have evidenced ownership, like tax statements, monthly maintenance statements. It was his opinion that his mother was the only owner. The respondents represented that the deed had been recorded, and indeed he had a choice, either quit claim the interest to the timeshare or pay the dues. When he pushed back again, they reiterated that that was the only choices he had. The third choice would be that they would collect against him for those timeshare dues. He hired our firm, and then when we confronted the respondents, we discovered that the deed had not been recorded. They then changed their story and said that it hadn't been recorded, and that was because it was would have been Ms. Engstrom's responsibility to record that. We also point out the inconsistencies in the other supporting documents, which purport to, one purporting to evince Ms. Engstrom's intent to have her son be a co-owner on a deed, but it's dated a year before she even purportedly owned anything, and that interest is missing a legal description and also is I don't know what the document it is, but it purports to be forming a relationship with one of the respondents while the deed is executed, purportedly conveyed from the other respondent. And there's no explanation, or never was any explanation of the internal consistencies related to that. We conducted an investigation and found other things that tended to show that the respondents' statements relating to the way the interest came to be and how our client became an owner were also false.
Thank you. And maybe you could return to the facts, although I think we probably know them. But
okay, great.
What claims were left at the district court? Consumer Fraud Act claim? Anything else?
Well, we amended another claim too for the under chapter.
Just that subdivided property, that lot. So the two statutory claims, is that all that's left?
Right. In fact, the amended complaint should reflect that.
Thank you. And then on a Consumer Fraud Act claim, mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand who is this group of victims that you believe may be out there to this type of fraud. As I understand your claim, it's that by asking your client to either disclaim his interest or to pay the maintenance fees, they somehow were defrauding him, or were they somehow defrauding other family members that would not then be able to share in mom's interest? I'm not sure who the victims are, the ultimate person who gets a joint survivorship in your theory, or the other family members who don't get to participate in the interest because it didn't go through probate. Can you explain to me who the other potential victims are of this alleged fraud?
The question conflates the what the injury is with who the what the purpose of this litigation would be under the Consumer Fraud Act. So as to who's injured, that's already been established. Our client is injured by the previous litigation and the Supreme Court's determination that merely having to pay an attorney to either have to enforce or refrain from enforcing a legal right was enough to constitute an injury. Who the affected people are related to this conduct, we state that as it's our theory is that this was the threats were an effort for the respondents to avoid the cost of probate or otherwise foreclosing the mom's interest. And so the claim
is the other victims.
Who are it would the victims? Be other any other well of we fraud. State that part of the and under the Consumer Fraud Act, you don't need to identify a victim. You need to identify the public benefit. And what my client is seeking is injunction to prevent this kind of conduct, the shaking down of him related to rights that they falsely asserted that he had when he didn't. The other affected consumers would be other people who have deceased family members who purportedly own an interest in a timeshare when they really don't.
It would be the people who I'm having trouble, frankly, understanding the shakedown when the offer was disclaim your interest or keep your interest and pay the maintenance fees. Why, how, if he could disclaim his interest with paying nothing and he believes he has nothing and they say you can pay nothing and keep nothing. I know that he consulted a lawyer and paid some legal fees and the Supreme Court decided that that would be sufficient injury. But what is the shakedown and the defrauding of him under consumer fraud what's the fraud and what's the shakedown?
Well, the false statement that he had an interest in real property when he didn't, to the extent to which he didn't have an interest in real estate, we reject the idea that signing a quick claim deed when you don't have an interest in real estate is a reasonable act. That's a title instrument that should only be used for somebody when they think they have an instrument of an interest in real estate. He didn't believe, and it turns out he did have a interest in real estate. So that's not the purpose for a quick claim deed.
And likewise, how did it turn out that he didn't have an interest? He believes his mom didn't, in fact, provide for him to have joint survivorship, but that
we don't believe that the deed that's been produced, the unrecorded deed, is a valid deed. But the elements of conveyance are intent and delivery. And our client never intended to own the property, and he never received any delivery of a deed that showed that he owned the property. So even if for some reason that deed is valid, which we don't think it is, even if it is, he never received it. He never intended to own the property. So even if it's facially correct, it's not a valid deed because he needs to evince his intent to be an owner of real estate, which he never did.
Counsel, are you disputing whether his mother signed that document?
Well, the deed is not signed by his mother. A deed only needs to be signed by the grantor. So the deed is only signed by the granting party. If you're asking about the other authorization letter.
But she certainly purchased from the grantor interest in the vacation property, and she apparently used it for over a decade.
That's not in dispute. That's correct.
And it seems that the existence of that document and the respondent's knowledge that it exists would create a cloud on the title.
Which document is the court referring to?
The document that indicates that both he and his mother have an interest in this property.
He didn't know it existed until a year after his mother died.
I understand he didn't, but would you agree that the existence of that document would constitute a cloud on the title as far as the respondent's concerned?
And I do not agree with that.
Transfers?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. I do not agree with that Torrens property, and it was never recorded. Mm-hmm. So an unrecorded Torrens document has no legal effect.
And that this mother's signature on the authorization, to oppose summary judgment, did you submit some evidence that that was a forgery?
No, we haven't submitted any evidence. We haven't conducted any discovery as to the authenticity of that document. But it doesn't matter whether it's her signature or not.
It doesn't. So even if mom intended and told respondents that she intends to make him a joint owner, and even if that doesn't matter, even if she in fact signed the authorization that informed respondents that that's what they wished and they acted in accordance with her wishes, they are still engaged in consumer fraud?
Well, those aren't the facts before us here. The joint authorization has a number of problems with it. And if the hypothetical, what if it was, if there was no issues with it, if it had a legal description and it indeed aligned with the deed and the two parties that were obligated to perform were the same party, would that be, that's changing three or four of the indicia of fraud that we think is the basis of consumer fraud. So that's not an easy, it would be a different case if that were the case. If these documents were consistent and indeed it had a legal description, we would argue, though, that her intent to do something still wouldn't matter because Dan Engstrom would still have to have the intent to own property and have the and actually accept the ownership. Because, again, conveyance is intent and delivery. But that would be a completely different case if those documents were correct. But they're not correct.
And can you explain what's incorrect about the documents again? What did the authorization say, and what are you saying it had to say? Go ahead.
Well, the authorization isn't a conveyance, so it doesn't really matter what it says. But I'm answering the question: would there still be consumer fraud? That would knock out half of the what we call the indicia of fraud that are the basis of the case. But what it doesn't have is a legal description.
And is there something that required his mother's authorization to include the legal description in order for the recipient of that authorization to give it effect? And if so, what is that? What is it that required the legal description in there?
The document itself. And so we're holding up the document to say it is not what respondents purport it is, because it's not clear what Ms. Engstrom was doing. It doesn't have a legal description. The second thing is
why is it unclear? Did she own multiple timeshares with them, or what makes that an unclear authorization?
That the form was clearly not filled out correctly, and it doesn't identify what real estate she's reportedly conveying. It's also dated a year before the deed, so it begs the question: at the time this authorization it came to existence, what is it that Ms. Engstrom owned? She didn't own any property. She didn't own it for another year. The next question is, why is there a year delay between those two documents? The next question is, with the joint authorization, that purports to be between Ms. Engstrom and one of the respondents, whereas the deed itself is between Ms. Engstrom and a different one of the respondents. And there's no explanation of how those two things come together. And again, as we start listing these things off, and there's more, for instance, relating to the notary and the conduct of the notary, that Ms. Dewey has gotten in trouble before for backdated deeds, and here we have a deed that we're suspicious of. You take all of these in totality, and you start to see that this attempt to try to get Mr. Engstrom to make a choice is not an innocent mistake. It was a calculated tactic to fulfill a business purpose for the association or for the timeshare company, and that is to avoid the cost of how they're going to have to adjudicate this Ms. Engstrom's property. Now, the fact that they didn't record the deed sort of gets them off the hook on one record, but makes their representations and pronouncements to Mr. Engstrom more suspect. And that's so that's, so that's
how does it help them with their costs of probating the family's interest in that timeshare? I mean, he's just one person that might be able to make a claim. I mean, how does that make the transfer of property back to them clean? Because there could be other claimants, other children.
Not if
the estate or debtors, you know.
If it's a joint deed, then he would take outside of probate. And so then the quick claim deed that they're proffering to him for him to sign would create clean title, would avoid probate. But my client is saying, I don't want to sign a legal document that says I own something that I never did. And so that's the problem, is that now the only way to resolve that interest, Ms. Engstrom's interest in real estate, without the existence of one of the things that can make it flow outside of probate, which is a joint deed, a trust, or a transfer and death deed, would be to probate the real estate. So,
but wouldn't you have to do that anyway if he claims no interest?
Yes, that's exactly my point. They would have to do that.
So what's the gain of doing what they did if they're going to have to do it anyway?
If he signed a deed, they wouldn't have to do it. And that was the whole ploy. Sign a deed or assume responsibilities for the timeshare. And that's the problem. Now,
do you have any allegations, counsel, for what the costs of needing to probate the timeshares would be, as opposed to sort of, you know, clearing? I mean, so as I understand your allegation, and you can tell me I'm wrong, it's that by saying that they own the property as tenants in common, they can easily clear title by either having a person who's directly responsible without going through probate to pay the maintenance fees, or they can clear title with a quitclaim deed and they can move on to the next owner and they can avoid needing to go through probate to figure out ownership interests of the timeshare. Is that correct? A correct statement of your allegation in paragraphs 102 and 103?
It's a joint title issue here. So a joint title, when one of the title holders dies, property would then flow through to the other joint title holder outside of probate. So right now, absent that, you know, there's other ways that real estate can flow outside of it. Yeah, they have to undertake the cost of either probating the property or foreclosing mom's interest to remove the clouds. So you ask, what was the cost? We haven't conducted discovery. I mean, the court could take notice of what those things generally cost, but they're not free, and they're surely cheaper than the alternative that the respondents were posing. I see my time is up. Can I complete my thought?
Yes, you may.
One of the things I didn't get a chance to argue here, and I'll talk about the rebuttal, is all this is arguing the merits of the case for which we haven't been able to undertake discovery.
Thank you, counsel. You will have five minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Von Korff.
Thank you. May it please the court. Gerald Von Korff on behalf of the White Birch Owners Association, their management agent, White Birch, and Breezy Point International. First of all, we disagree with counsel's statement that the Supreme Court determined that there was an injury. The Supreme Court determined that if the facts are as stated in the complaint, if they are proved, then the attorney's fees expended in dealing with the alleged frauds, the notary using a revoked notary and falsely concocting a deed claim, that then that would constitute an injury. But what was required in order to prove an injury is to establish the facts behind those claims. And Mr. Engstrom had two basic claims as to how he was injured. One was the revoked notary claim, and the second one was the falsely concocted deed claim. And the essence of this case, the first part of the case, the individual claims case, they both of those claims lacked evidence, and the undisputed evidence established they were not true. As to the invalid notarization claim, which the plaintiff told the Supreme Court was the linchpin of his consumer fraud case, it's been known since 2017 when Michelle Dewey signed an affidavit that her commission was not revoked, that it was not revoked, but then the parties submitted data practices requests to find the revocation order, and the revocation order does not exist. But that wasn't good enough, so we had a deposition of the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Commerce filed an affidavit saying, no, her commission was never revoked. So on the invalid notarization claim, both as to the individual claim and this claim of hundreds of defrauded consumers that was registered improperly noticed deed, that is plainly summary judgment should have been granted.
Can I ask you, counsel?
Yes.
As I understand the complaint by the plaintiff is that he was given the choice of a quick claim deed that would disclaim his interest, or he would pay the maintenance fees and then he would continue as a joint survivor and he'd have ownership of the interest. And you probably understand my question. I'm not exactly sure who's harmed in that, whether it's like the poor siblings who didn't get part of the interest or if you're harmed by having an interest. But in any event, I think that the argument was that the quitclaim deed that would be asked to be signed would require him to falsely assert that he had some ownership interest in it. Could you speak to that, please? Would a quitclaim deed, would it require the person to actually falsely say that they had an interest that they were, that they did not believe themselves to have in order to give it up?
No, Your Honor, absolutely. A quitclaim deed simply gives up the claim that you have, if you have one, and nothing if you don't have it. It's just a title clearing enterprise. If Mr. Engstrom signed the quitclaim deed, it doesn't solve title problems at all because it doesn't give up the claims of anyone else who claims. So, and furthermore, because the quitclaim deed is coming from a person who's not registered in the Torrens proceeding, all it does is take care of what Judge Kirk mentioned, the problem that White Birch cannot dispose of this deed without establishing that there's no claim there. It's a cloud on title. But because Mr. Engstrom is outside the chain of title, because his mother didn't register the deed, he's outside the chain of title, and there's still going to be a proceeding subsequent. The state has to be notified. Mr. Engstrom has to be notified. And if someone makes a claim, hey, he didn't own it, then the due process is all there. The other thing I would say is this circumstance where someone makes a gift in order to avoid probate, right? That's what these joint tenancies are. They're designed to avoid probate. And his mother had no probate assets, right? She had no probate assets except this. And so she put the natural object of her bounty on the deed to avoid probate. But that being said, it's not uncommon at all that a parent or a relative leaves something to a child or relative, but the child or relative doesn't want it. And there's a uniform statute that deals with this because it's very common. And the Minnesota Uniform Property Interest Disclaimer Act tells lawyers what they need to do when that happens because it's so common. And that is when a person receives a gift they don't want, they need to disclaim it in a binding way. And the binding way under the Disclaimer Act for this property is a quitclaim deed. And it's a no harm quitclaim deed. They and so all we're dealing with here is a situation where if a lawyer looks at this request for a quitclaim deed, he tells the client, "You don't want it. The simplest way to get rid of it and is sign the disclaimer as the statute requires."
So, counsel, may I ask, part of the issue, one of the issues is whether there is an asserted, an alleged public benefit. So I'm not exactly sure, if the case is that there's a disputed fact over whether mom, in fact, signed the authorization or whether, the respondents actually are concocting this scheme to falsely tell family members that their parent, made them a joint tenant when they didn't because it reduces costs, et cetera. You know, the theory of this case. Is there a way in which, in this case, and the district court, though, did not permit discovery, further discovery from the respondents on beyond the before deciding the summary judgment motion. Is there any way in which at this point, without discovery of the respondents, that the plaintiff knew who any other timeshare owners were or other people where they could ascertain or do any of their own work to determine whether anyone else had faced this circumstance?
I'd like to answer that in two parts. First of all, there was discovery on the validity of the deed. The notary testified. She was cross-examined as to whether she misspelled the name. The grantor who signed the grantor, she was cross-examined. The notarization itself creates a prima facie validity of the deed, and there's not a shred of evidence. This idea that this deed was fabricated was and is without foundation. It shouldn't have been put in the complaint. I mean, they were saying that it was invalid because it came in 2002, but they just misread the purchase agreement. The purchase agreement called it for it. They claimed that there should have been another deed, but if there was another deed, she would have had it, and it wasn't registered. They can't produce it. So,
is there a theory that it's invalid? Part of it, I understand, it had to do with a notary, but isn't there a suggestion here that they just made it up of whole cloth and mom never, ever authorized joint survivorship?
But you can't do that simply by wishing it to be true. So, I mean, in my early days, I did a lot of consumer fraud case. You don't make up consumer fraud. You go out and find a basis for it. And there's no basis for this. It's just rampant speculation in order to serve the proceeding. Summary judgment on the fabricated deed claim was properly granted. There was full discovery of the people who signed the deed. I'm not trying to evade your other question.
Yeah, so let's get back to my other question. Are there any other, in other words, deed holders of the respondents where they could look to see, hey, did you get a surprising letter from the respondents at some point after a parent died and et cetera?
All of these deeds except this one, all of the deeds are registered. Their claim was the registered deeds. And so, all right, they went and looked at some deeds, and what they found, they brought forward 13 deeds, 11 of them were joint tenants, husband and wife, and two of them were single individuals. But in order for this invented scam to have existed, let's just imagine that this Engstrom thing was done in the way it's described. What the record is going to show is a quitclaim deed back to the owners association or White Birch, because that's where it's going. It's going back to the owners association from a single individual. So that and in order for this to be a big scam, there have to be bunches of people who died doing this, right? So the registry is laid out. If there were such a case, and there's not, you'd find it in the registry. All of the names of the consumers are available to Mr. Christensen.
That's my question. So could Mr. Christensen know the names of the consumers to see whether, in fact, those who got joint survivorship did so because they chose to pay the maintenance fees, notwithstanding the fact that they didn't know about it was happening, and then they got joint survivorship, or so they could talk to them and see whether anyone else had the same surprise? Is that available without discovery? That's my question.
Absolutely, and this is common in consumer fraud cases. You check the small claims. You go and look. He did look for deeds, and he produced 13 of them. And the joint tenancies were husband and wife. And if we're going to start saying that it's a consumer fraud because husbands and wives sign deeds in order to avoid probate, I mean, where are we headed?
Counsel, here's my question. So I just want to take, for example, in the amended complaint, paragraph 94, it says, upon information and belief, it is the common practice for defendants and their employees to knowingly misrepresent purported title instruments, like the suspect deed, which purport to demonstrate the existence of title to a timeshare property when no interest actually exists. And my question is, how could they support that allegation without having discovery in order to discover your client's common practice?
You can't make an allegation like that under Rule 9 without having something first.
Well, I think they're saying that something is Mr. Engstrom. I'm just repeating. I think their argument is that there's enough to plead with particularity that this has happened as to one person, and so now they're entitled to discovery to see if this has happened to others. I think that's their argument.
I think that's what they're claiming. But Mr. Engstrom's case was dismissed by summary judgment. He doesn't have a case. You're absolutely right. He's saying my deed was fabricated, right? Just asking him to fix title is not a fraud.
His argument that he should have been entitled to discovery on these facts before the court decided summary judgment is, I think, his argument.
He had discovery on the validity of the deed. So following your point, he says there's a fabricated deed, and he says, since it's a fabricated deed, I should go find some more, but it's not a fabricated deed, and summary judgment was properly granted. The fabricated deed was just simply made up. There's not a shred of evidence. He doesn't have any evidence, and the judge properly granted summary judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Christensen, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The deed that we're all talking about is a copy of a deed. I want to be clear about that. We don't know where the original is. The idea that we conducted discovery related to the propriety of that document is not true. And you can look at our reply to see how respondents cut off any avenues or that particular investigation into anything other than the limited discovery that the court said we could conduct related to the notary's licensure or validity of the notary's notarizations. The other deeds we cited to in the complaint were to dispel one of the representations that respondents made. They said that it's the homeowner's responsibility to record deeds. The other deeds that we recite to in the complaint are all consecutively numbered, meaning that the people that recorded them either all confederated when they went down to the courthouse to record them, to the county recorder to record them, or the registrar, or somebody else recorded them on their behalf, tending to indicate that another representation of respondents is not true related to the purpose and the origin of the deed. We haven't undertaken any discovery related to the chain of custody of the deed to find out how this copy came to be. And Your Honor's calling out of the one paragraph where we call out that it's our contention that this deed was manufactured to do exactly what we say was happening here, to compel my client to solve a business problem for the respondents. The idea that we could undertake some sort of discovery outside of the court's mandate, I think is,
it's investigation, not discovery of the other parties. Could you investigate by reaching out to other persons on a deed, the other joint deed holders, and say, how did you come into joint ownership of this? Tell me, so you could explore whether similar circumstances happen, or look at other titles or whatever in public records. Investigate on your own whether there's anyone that you could advance that says, I faced a similar situation. So therefore, this is a broader public benefit question than just my unique situation.
Yeah, we could. However, once the court entered its limited discovery order, I think we were looking at a potential contempt motion if we were to do that.
To just make phone calls and investigate on your own without discovery?
Well, the question is, what was the purpose of the limited discovery order? We've laid out why we don't think it comports with the rules, but the choice we were facing there is we don't think this is appropriate, but we don't want to create the appearance that we're going around it. So I will tell you that we didn't conduct any investigation, anything that could possibly be discovery. Surely we didn't issue any subpoenas and we didn't make any phone calls outside the confines of what the order said we could do.
And how about years prior to that order? Because the case was brought a number of years ago. I'm just wondering, as to the public benefit, what evidence did you put in that someone else, through your own investigation even, faced a similar circumstance?
Well, the case was dismissed pretty soon after we commenced it. So again, conducting investigation after a case has been dismissed also has the appearance of impropriety. So we didn't do anything until it was reversed and remanded from the Supreme Court. And the next thing we did is put together a discovery plan. And the next thing that happened was told that we had limited discovery. So I'm not trying to be cute here and say that we couldn't have done some investigation. Sure, we could have. But at the point, there's two major points where it would have looked like it was improper. And the respondents' allegations have been ad hominem attacks against me in part of this litigation, quite a lot of this litigation. And so I'm trying to do this by the book, and that's our prerogative. So no, we didn't do any, and that's the reason why, any investigation.
So counsel, where's your proof that the deed was fabricated? I mean, that seems to be one of the respondents' strongest contentions.
Well, we don't have proof that it was fabricated. We have evidence that tends to indicate it's not what it purports to be. Number one, that after Ms. Engstrom's death, first of all, our client never saw it, never received anything that was consistent with his ownership of the property. Number two, after Ms. Engstrom's death, they conveniently discovered that this thing existed by looking through their files. It begs the question, if it was there all along, how come they couldn't have communicated that. I see I've run out of time. May I continue to answer
the question? They would have been communicating with her, though, prior to her death.
I'm out of time. May I answer you?
As far as I'm concerned, it's up to the
chair. Yes, you may.
Great. Thank you. Well, no, if they're joint owners, they should be communicating with both of them. And that's the whole question, is that when you start to look at these, we call them indicia of fraud, there's no proof, but there's a whole lot of stuff that doesn't add up here. And the discovery of the deed may just be happenstance mistake on a number of people's parties, but sure is convenient. And when you take a look at that in conjunction with the threats to sue, the efforts to collect, the representations that were false, the ability
but
to do that.
But counsel, it was notarized back in 2002.
By a notary who has backdated deeds in the past. Another reason that we have a basis to at least look further into why this copy of a deed came to be. And she backdated deeds for the convenience of the respondents in the past. And she's not, neither her nor her boss have any contrition about that mistake after she was dinged by the Department of Commerce for doing that. They don't think they did anything wrong. Again, leading to the conclusion, the basis that they're doing something, something's going on that doesn't add up here. And it could be innocent mistake on a very significant level, or they can be doing what they were doing in the past. I thank the panel for its time this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsels for your argument in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter in the time period prescribed by statute.